Are you all sitting comfortable to swear on your body? Then I'll begin.
This is Blueprint for Living, the last half hour. I'm Jonathan Green. Settle in, drape yourself in a doona. We're going to get hoogly. This week, comfort. Comfort is a strangely complex thing. It's close to lethargy, but a neighbour of contentment. We look for it in times of trouble and dream of it in strife.
By the year 2000, I would like to see an Australian nation that feels comfortable and relaxed about three things. I would like to see them comfortable and relaxed about their history. I'd like to see them comfortable and relaxed about the present. And I'd also like to see them comfortable and relaxed about the future. You can't possibly hope to feel excited about something unless you feel comfortable and familiar with it.
Dr. Jordan McKenzie is a lecturer in sociology at the University of Wollongong. Jordan, are we more preoccupied than ever with our own comfort?
I think to some degree, comfort is something that people are yearning for, something that people seem to really be interested in. I mean, I guess my interest in this is often around why that might be the case and what it is that might lead people to be so interested in comfort. I mean, I guess if I think about this question being flipped upside down, I mean, imagine this interview being about discomfort. I would be thinking about maybe people seeking discomfort in terms of things like, I don't know, like extensive tattoos or running very painful marathons or something. I might see that as a reflection of people feeling too bored or unchallenged. If the inverse of that is people seeking comfort, it makes me wonder to what extent this reflects a society of people who are stressed, who are tired, who are worn out, and so on.
Let's get to those possible causative factors in a sec. But to begin, though, let this define our terms, the sort of comfort that people are seeking. Where do you see that? What are we looking for and in what places?
It's a good question. There's really quite a few different ways we can think about comfort. We're talking about people living very, very busy, very stressful lives who are seeking relief, a way to recuperate from daily stresses and daily challenges. So I guess I'm thinking about comfort here in terms of a retreat to often domestic sort of private spaces, such that we go to work and we sort of come home ready, not necessarily to engage in other activities, but to simply just sort of find some form of comfort and relaxation.
Utterly exhausted and in need of sanctuary.
I think so. I mean, look, a lot of my research is on happiness and the good life. And one of the things about I sort of come across in this area is about expectation and ambition. And it strikes me that the comfort is a fairly low bar to meet in terms of finding some form of satisfaction or fulfillment. That a lot of the things that bring us a lot of happiness also require a lot of work, and in some cases a lot of risk. Comfort, on the other hand, is to me, I think, a more passive experience, something that is, you know, where you're putting very little in but kind of getting very little back. So I guess, you know, the stereotype of coming home from work and watching something on TV and eating a takeaway pizza and having a glass of wine or something is a form of comfort, but it's also not really a fulfilling form of behavior. It's not something that's going to make you feel well necessarily.
I guess it's the counter side of a whole lot of other things in the world and in our lives that are fundamentally dysfunctional.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I've become concerned about is the way in which this kind of activity or this behavior can take us out of the public or political realm, and the extent to which it kind of isolates us and makes us quite perhaps more individualistic than we would otherwise be.
But I wonder if there's something about the world, about the extremity of so much that we see around us that makes us seek comfort, which is a sort of an erasure more than an engagement.
I think maybe the key aspect here is about control. I think a lot of people are increasingly feeling as though they don't have control of their everyday lives. And comfort to me is a form of satisfaction that is very easy to control. I guess in terms of other forms of happiness that might be more of a gamble, you know, maybe trying to find happiness in a relationship that might not turn out. Comfort is fairly predictable. You know, I know what I'm going to get out of my, pizza and a glass of wine in front of the TV. You know, my sofa doesn't let me down in that sense. And so comfort is definitely something where we can perhaps feel like we are getting back an element of control over our fulfillment and our well-being.
And yet, sadly, binging on TV under the doona over the weekend, surrounded by emptying pizza boxes, is not necessarily a way to attain the thing you mentioned before, happiness.
No, it's not. And I think this is because of the sort of passivity of it. I guess I want to be careful here because to me there are some contradictions. I mean, I think comfort is something that could be seen as, I don't know, maybe a bit of a false promise in terms of recuperating us. And I worry that we end up in a situation where we are so exhausted from work and so emotionally burnt out from work that we sort of don't have enough to pursue other kinds of interests. You know, that comfort as recuperation could really just become an extension of work. You know, that instead of, going to work and then coming home and doing something for you, your comfort and your relaxation actually just becomes about getting yourself into a position where you can go back to work the next day. And in that sense, I would say that leisure time is really just an extension of work time. But I would also, I guess, want to think about comfort as a potentially enriching thing. And I certainly wouldn't want to sort of try and threaten or take away people's very sort of healthy desire for comfort.
Jordan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jordan McKenzie. This then should be a golden age of comfort. A state to aspire to in the midst of so much churning, turmoil and uncertainty. Comfort is the final reward of the anxious. Comfort, though, need not be idle or supine. I feel the most comfort free of the pressing weight of things to think or do. A moment that can only be enjoyed having done them first. Comfort, truly comfort, is the repose of completeness. Galen Kranz is a professor in the Graduate School at Berkeley, author of The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body and Design. Galen, welcome.
Thank you.
Chairs are not one of your favourite things.
That's right. I think they've done us quite a lot of harm, so I'm not too fond of them. When I discovered all the problems that they produce for us physically, I had to ask, why do we have them if they're not very good for us? And really, it's about social status. Once upon a time, we wanted to be pharaohs and kings. And so it was a cool posture socially, but it really wasn't very good for us physically.
So once upon a time, did people just move between standing and lying down?
They squatted a lot and would sit cross-legged or perch halfway between sitting and standing. And sometimes they would sit, but not for long periods of time like we do today.
It takes a bit of an effort to avoid sitting these days. I mean, the world is very much geared around offering you a place to perch.
Well, unfortunately, not what I call the perch. I call the perch the position halfway between sitting and standing.
Okay.
But it's really difficult to avoid the classic right angle seated posture. It's very, very difficult because we do recreation, work, eating. The right angle posture has become all too ubiquitous.
Now, it may have its physical disadvantages, and as you say, it has become quite ubiquitous, but it's also been the chair, a thing which has attracted the eye of almost every architect in history. What's the secret of that fascination?
Well, it's a three-dimensional object that has some of the properties of a little tiny building, and it's a lot faster and easier to design one of those. So it's often a kind of a teething problem for beginning design students in architecture training, and you can build them yourself, so there's a kind of fascination, and famous architects have said that designing a chair is a huge challenge, more challenging even than a building.
I wonder if it's almost a less than virtuous circle that perhaps we could break if there was some other project that would appeal to novitiate design students other than chairs. We might have a healthier population.
That's possible, but it's not really the designer's fault. It's a much broader cultural problem that we think it's good to sit in this right classic right angle seated posture. You know, chairs were once upon a time rare commodities. And Industrial Revolution, everybody could have a chair. So it was like, oh, suddenly everybody could be important. And so now we think we're little royals when we sit. And everyone thinks squatting is beneath them. And other cultures did not always assume this posture. India and Japan, China had other ways of getting together to eat, converse, conduct business. People squatted and sat cross-legged. And there have been 1,000 named postures. There's an anthropologist called Hughes who wrote an article in the Scientific American on the 1,000 named postures in the world. And we use about 3 of them, standing, lying down, and sitting.
We're so unimaginative. I mean, I take your point on that origin story of wanting to replicate the important person on their chair, but surely we're so removed from that. Surely the greater driver now is simply some idea of comfort.
Ah, yes, comfort. That notion has transformed over time to mean something like yielding ease. And so we like chairs that are soft and squishy. But originally, the word comfort meant to strengthen, like to comfort someone in time of distress. You know, the word literally means with is come and fort is strength. So once it meant to strengthen, and I think we should go back to that meaning of the word and talk about comfort as alignment rather than yielding ease and collapse.
And culturally, if that is a notion which is, you know, that idea of alignment, if that is something which people are brought up to, then their body follows that teaching. Their body becomes comfortable in those postures.
That's right. Exactly right. Sitting in chairs, you weaken your torso. And then if you lean back on the chair back, I mean, it's the difference, of course, you know, between the stool and a chair is the chair back. Mm. If you use the chair back, you weaken your torso, and then you become so weak that you need the chair back for support because you can't sit autonomously any longer. And the more you use it, the weaker you get, and the more you need it.
What for you, Garland, is your most comfortable position?
Halfway between sitting and standing with the thighs at an oblique angle to the torso. And then if you rotate that position in space, you get a lounge chair.
Ah, suddenly I have a vision of intense comfort. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
I want comfort, but must work for it through these little forests of unpleasantness and effort. Is comfort food, that slow braise dished from memory? Or the inner glow of some new flavour tried for the first time and strangely, surprisingly, comfortingly perfect. Now, when I think of comfort, I think carbs. Buffy Gorilla, Blueprint's roving carb eater, went to meet the master of refined comfort food.
Come through.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? Nice to meet you.
Guy. My name is Guy Grossi, and we're at Grossi Florentino in the kitchen of our restaurant here at Grossi Florentino. The word comfort food evokes to me memories of growing up, the home kitchen, watching mum cook beautiful food, and I always think of lovely, sumptuous pasta dishes, things that make me feel like I'm back in my childhood.
And I think a lot of people tend to think comfort food equals carbohydrates. I know I do, guilty. But do you feel like there's comfort food in other forms of the dishes we eat?
Absolutely. It's not always about carbohydrates, although today we're doing a pasta dish for you. But over here, I'm braising some lovely veal shanks, which is going to be really rich and beautiful and very comforting. But it's got no carbohydrate in it. It's protein.
And what's your favourite comfort dish?
The tortellini that I'm going to make for you today is one of my favourites. I can never say no to a serving of great lasagna. I love it. But the thing when I remember the most growing up is my mother taught me to make this wonderful ragu with calamari, because you can't eat meat on Good Friday. So we braise the calamari up and we put fettuccine with it, and it's just to die for. Every Good Friday we have that dish.
So what are we going to make today?
Today we're going to make some tortellini alla zucca. So it's a tortellini filled with pumpkin, and we're going to do some lovely nut brown butter and sage with that. So I'm going to show you how to make that now.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Okay. So what we have here is some beautiful pasta that we use in our restaurant. It's been worked many, many times through our pasta roller. It's also been well rested so it doesn't spring back, and that's really important when making pasta. Then we're going to cut some beautiful, elegant circles out of this. You can make this with squares as well, but I feel that it's a lot more elegant in the circles. Okay, here we have our pumpkin mix. Now that's been roasted. I use a Kent pumpkin. They're a really sweet, beautiful pumpkin. They've just been roasted in the oven, like in slices, with nothing on them. And then they start to caramelize and go brown, and that's when you know they're ready. We take them out. It really intensifies the sugar. We make a base using leek and chili and garlic, and then we put the pumpkin in there, which purees up together, and I put some Parmigiano in there as well. Now, I have some here that I've got in a piping bag for us to make it easier to get into our tortellini.
Here's one we made earlier.
Yeah. We're going to pipe a little bit of our pumpkin mixture into each of those tortellini.
So it's just a tiny little mound. It doesn't look like you've overstuffed it.
You don't want to overstuff it, otherwise they can break open. So just a tiny little amount.
What's your tortellini technique?
Fold it in half into what would be called an agnolotti shape. This is a little agnolotti. And then kind of in half again. And we roll it around on itself to form a lovely little elegant tortellini like that.
Not to take away from the magic, but that looks much easier than I anticipated.
Next, we're going to go to the stove. We've got a little bit of butter here. I like some butter in it.
So is that salted or unsalted?
This is unsalted butter. We're going to add some salt. Now, we'll get our padella, pop it on the stove, get the fire going underneath it. We don't want it to get super hot, but just start to warm that pan up. If it gets too hot, the butter will burn straight away. So I'm going to pop that butter in now and just let it start to do its thing. Now, what I'm going for here is a bit of nuttiness. So I'm going to cook that butter till it just has a little bit of nuttiness to it. So, it's going to start to change colour.
And how long should that take?
A couple of minutes. Won't take long at all. I've got some beautiful sage leaves from my garden. I'm going to just pop those in there because I don't think we need to chop it up. It can look quite nice just like that. And I'll let them just sizzle away in there while the butter's cooking. Now, while that's going on, we need to cook our tortellini. These will only take about, because it's fresh pasta, it'll only take 3 or so minutes in the boiling water. Make sure the water is boiling and it has plenty of salt in the water. All right, that's getting to about where I want it to be. So I'm going to just shake it around. Still going. I'm going to stop it where I want it so it doesn't burn. And now it's about exactly where I want it to be, and I stop it using some of the pasta water.
Fire.
So that's beautiful and ready. I'm going to add some seasoning to that. A little sale, a little pepper. This is some beautiful cracked pepper. We're about ready to go now. There's a little tortellini in there.
Just a little shake about.
Because what I'm doing now is I'm bringing that lovely nutty butter together with a little bit of the liquid from the cooker and the lovely flour that's around the pasta, so we're forming a little emulsion in there. There's a little bowl coming out, goes on the bench. Gonna add some Parmigiano Reggiano, typical of the region where this dish is from, which is Emilia Romana. Classically, they make this dish in Modena. You could just stop there, leave it there, or you could keep going further.
How are you going to make this even more comfortable?
Well, I've got some lovely fried sage leaves here, which have just been fried in hot oil. That's going to add a little crispiness to it. I've got some beautiful crumbs made from Amaretti biscuits.
The almond biscuit.
Classic almond biscuit. Classic in this dish in Modena. Sometimes it's used inside the mixture. That's going to add a little texture and a little bit of sweetness. Radio Andrea, mi prendi il balsamico per piacere. And if that doesn't make you comfortable, I don't know what does.
So good.
Do you like it?
so delicious.
Excellent. I'm happy you like it.
The pasta is just perfect. The filling is so sweet, like you were saying, with the mm-hmm. roasted squash. I feel anyone be comforted by this.
You're very
Thank
kind.
You so
Thank
much.
You.
The only thing between your family and the big rough world outside is their clothes and you. So the least you can do is wrap them with love and clothe them with softness. Without comfort, sad and flat. With comfort, all soft and bouncy again.
Mel Campbell is a journalist, author, cultural critic. Mel, haute comfort dressing. What on earth?
I don't understand why you would have any problem with comfort dressing. It's the best kind of dressing. We've heard a lot about active wear. I think inactive wear is the future. I unfortunately am fully dressed as I speak to you today, but that's an unusual day for me because normally I am in my pyjamas most of the day. And to be frank, a lot of my day wear is very pyjama-like as well.
Well, this, I mean, pyjamas is, it's making the jump into, daily fashion. People are picking that sort of doona shrouded look. It's become a catwalk thing.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Just the other day I was walking down the street and I saw two men coming towards me dressed in identical down jackets. They looked like Michelin men, twin Michelin men. And I realised that those jackets are cool. That's the winter jacket nowadays. No one wears overcoats really in Melbourne, at least. And I think that the whole idea of being cosy is so important to the way people are dressing. Maybe it's the bleak times we're living in. But people, I think, just want to feel good, and clothes are a way to feel good.
Because for so long, the idea of fashion has been, it's been analogous with a certain amount of discomfort. It's, I guess, refreshing to see that table turned.
Well, that's right. I mean, you will read letters and diaries from the 18th century complaining about how awful the clothes were, but that in order to fit in with society and to look fashionable, in quite a political sense. Often these were high fashion women from the upper class who felt that to move in particular circles, in royal circles, court circles, in politically influential circles, they had to dress the right way and to appear in public in particular ways. But privately, in the letters that they wrote to each other, they hated it. And in their diaries, they complained about how their clothes would pinch them, their shoes were terrible. But they said, that's what it takes, so I'm going to do it. But maybe nowadays people are realizing that you can still be in the world, have influence in the world, without it necessarily depending on what you wear.
It's a line of thinking, though, which can disturbingly take us, I suspect, in a blink towards Ugg boots and onesies in public places.
Yes. Now, I don't want to be seen to put more Vaseline on that slippery slide because I think Ugg boots are terrible. And I noticed a man just crossing the road near my house the other day. He was wearing a shirt, a pair of shorts, and Ugg boots. What struck me about this was the kind of sloppishness of that outfit that really annoyed me. The idea that he didn't look like he had been bothered to put on a pair of proper shoes. So perhaps we can use care as a concept rather than trying to impress others.
But in this pursuit of comfort in the way we dress in the world, I mean, there's a disregard there for some of the rules that used to apply in the public space. It's almost like an appropriation of the public space as our own and sort of a contempt for that idea that this is where you dress up for other people.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're in an era, I think, of tension between this concept of public decorum as being a way to show respect for others, but also the idea that we as sovereign individuals should be able to exist in the world however we like. So it's when those two ideas butt up against each other is when we have ideas like manspreading on public transport, of people wearing tracksuit pants to business talks. Although, of course, I'm doing this interview with you via Skype, so I could be wearing anything I liked. I rest assured I am fully dressed again, but that's where we have this idea of whose is the public sphere. Is it for me and for my aims and agendas, or is it for me to share with other people, and therefore I've got to be more considerate about how I look to them and their comfort in relation to me, not just my own?
Mel Campbell, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to The Last Half Hour, this week on comfort. You heard Jordan McKenzie, lecturer in sociology at the University of Wollongong, Galen Cranz, professor emerita of architecture at Berkeley and author of The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body and Design, Guy Grossi, chef, owner of Grossi Florentino, author of Cellar Bar, and Mel Campbell, journalist, author, cultural critic. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green.